There we go. That was a couple cuts from Bill Evans' new album, In Good Company, because I was fumbling around, fat fingering the conversation down to Sonny, but I finally connected everybody up. So right now I have on the phone Bill Evans and Sonny Osborne.
Hey there, Chief. How you doing? How was your Thanksgiving?
Good. Pretty good. How about you?
Good, yeah. Well, my daughter was home, and my son, you know, had the whole family here and some friends, and I spent all day cleaning the house. I was working. I have more work than I thought I would have to do, but it was good. my wife even had me ironing the napkins. Have you ever done that?
Oh, for crying out loud! She cleaned the house before they got there.
Clean the house before they got there? Yeah, I wanted to clean for the guests. Then you got to clean it again, I guess, right?
Well, then they don't really know how you live, do they?
No one knows how I live.
Oh, yes. Oh. That's funny. I don't know why. I do that, too. But I wonder why.
Well, we just want to put the best face forward for our guests, you know.
Well, why not keep it forward always, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know. I definitely know. Now, Sonny, have you told the people that listen to Steve Martin's radio show that you drive a Prius?
I have.
I don't know if I have or not.
I have.
I think that's amazing. I wish I had one. That's going to be one of my next cars someday if I ever have to buy another one.
Well, what's so amazing about it? I'm serious about that. What is so amazing about it?
Oh, you're asking me?
Yeah. Well,
no. Yeah.
Well, the fact that you have a Prius?
Yeah.
Well, you know, now that I think about it, it's really, I was surprised when you first said this because I just, you know, I've just known you to have, you know, pickup trucks and sports cars, and you know, you've had a lot of different cars since I've known you.
Every car that's ever been made, I think I've got one of them. I gotta find. Oh boy, this is gonna get political. I gotta find that Democrat. Democrat inflation somewhere.
Now you own. I'm gonna deflect that for just a moment, but you owned a Rambler too, right?
Oh man,
1963, yeah.
That was
one of my biggest mistakes I ever made when I bought one of those.
My first car was a Gremlin.
Ooh, boy, that's
I was American Motors.
Now, that's a hard looker right there.
And if you're under 40 years old, 40 years old, you've probably never even seen one of these cars because none of them survived.
How could they? I mean, you look closely at that, and how could it survive?
Well, that car was great on dates, however, because I would take a left turn, and the passenger seat would just go flat back. And I had to take a broomstick, and I just put the broomstick in the back to keep the seat up. And then you take a right turn, and the passenger door would just come open.
All right, now I have to interject here because I just want to remind everybody again that we're talking about banjos, and we've already used the term geometry and modulation, and now we're back to broomsticks. So maybe we're bringing it back home.
Well, we've used the word gremlin.
Gremlin.
Gremlin is probably,
right.
Probably
okay.
a new word.
Hey, son.
I'll tell you that, that car that I had, and not these, so we'll talk about banjos in a minute.
All right.
That car that I had was a 1963, and I bought it, and it was nearly new. And I got in it one day and drove it about 4 or 5 miles, and the oil light came on. And I thought, you know what, this car is almost new, and it says add oil. And I thought, I'm not going to put up with this. So we went and got another car.
That's not a good sign.
No, not at all. But that was one of my biggest mistakes, buying that car. And but you know, everything works out for the best. And it was good to know that that they made cars like that. You know.
Well, and this is even a more obscure point, but you remember the television show Mr. Ed?
Yeah.
Well, they all drove American Motors cars on that show. It's just a childhood memory that I have. I just kind of coming out of nowhere, but at any rate.
Really? I didn't know that.
They did. If you ever see a, you know, rerun of that, they're all driving American Motors cars.
We were going to try so hard not to make this political, and of course we know who the head of American Motors was, but that's all right.
Who was the head of American Motors?
I'll tell politics if you want.
No, thanks.
Who was the head of American Motors? I don't know.
I thought it was George.
I don't know.
I thought it was George Romney.
Oh, really?
I believe so.
Well,
let's get off of this. Let's get off of this. Let's get off of that name. All right. Sonny, we've been having a great time, at least Bill and I have. I assume people listening, but we've been listening to a lot of cuts from his new album, In Good Company, and we got some of your stuff queued up here too, which Bill's going to talk as only he can about some of the stuff you record, and I got a lot of good stuff that he's asked me to pull up, and Bill, why don't you just do a little introduction, as only you can do, to what we want to do.
Well, sure. Sonny, Steve and I were talking earlier about how, in many ways, the creativity that you had as a banjo player and the Osborne Brothers had as a band, and I know that you were largely responsible for a lot of the sound of the Osborne Brothers and what happened in the recording studio, that personally, in my mind, I view your accomplishments on the same plateau as one of my favorite groups, the Beatles, and with the use of instrumentation, the creative things that you guys did with singing. And I actually sent Steve a track of Siempre, and mm-hmm. we're going to listen to this, that's from that KET television special. So this is not the commercial version with the Nashville studio musicians, but it's just the Osborne Brothers.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. All right, I'm going to click that on, and then that's about a minute and 52, Bill. That's the one you want?
It's short.
Let's do that one, then we'll come right back on. So you guys chat amongst yourselves, and I'm going to send this out to the audience. So let me just make the switch. We're back on live. We just finished a shortcut of Siempre that Bill sent me earlier this morning so we could play that and talk to Sonny. And Sonny, you were discussing the original title of Siempre, and go ahead, because it's a good story.
Say that again. Yeah.
It was in the, as I remember, it was like at the, we needed one more tune, it was written right there in the studio, though. And it was originally titled El Cuello Rojo Blues, which translates to the Redneck Blues. that's what I was going to call it. And Hal Rugg was fluent in Spanish. And Owen Bradley didn't say anything about it, and so he asked what the name of it was, and I told him. And Hal Rugg said, "You're going to call this the Redneck Blues?" And boy, Owen came out of the control room, and he said, "You can't do that. I didn't know that's what you were going to call it." I said, "Well, El Cuello Rojo Blues." And he said, "You gotta name it something else," and so I named it. I always liked the Pete Drake recording of "Always" or "Forever" or whatever. "Always," I think it was. And so "Siempre" means "always" or "forever" in Spanish. So that's what I named it.
Now, see today, Sonny, if you just had the title "Redneck Blues," it would be a hit, even if you didn't have a song attached to it.
Well, I just thought it'd be neat to call it El Cuello Rojo Blues. And in Spanish, that translated, I think the neck is red, is what it is. I was going to do, when we did the Bonnie and Clyde thing on RCA Victor, they wanted Falling Out and Breakdown, and I was my gosh, I can't remember what it was in Spanish now. I was going to call it that. And I forgot how to pronounce it, so I didn't. Anyhow,
it's a great tune.
Good to me. Chester Atkins recorded it on RCA Victor in 60-something, 5, 6, somewhere along there, along his guitar albums. It sold probably 150,000, 200,000 of them, and then we recorded it a little bit later and sold a great amount of about 30,000, I think.
Well, and I can't really remember anybody playing the banjo in that way. You know, of course, you had already had a track record of adapting banjo to country sounds anyway, but never really kind of a full tune like this, right? Was there anything that you recorded before Siempre that, you know, was an instrumental in that style? I don't remember.
No, I didn't. And I didn't even realize it, but I enjoyed playing that kind of stuff other than just old knockdown, drag out, up-tempo, fast things. I love volume up and breakdown and all that stuff, but I liked it, but I'd rather play stuff like Siempre. Well, I wrote I had 3 or 4 like that. El Ronda was one of them. In fact, El Ronda, I think, means the pickpocket.
Yeah.
In Spanish. And I did, I think I did three or four of them, I think. Spanish type things. Dandelion was one of them, too.
A great source, by the way, if you're a banjo player out there listening, for some of these tunes is the Homespun Tape instructional video that Sonny did, and both Dandelion and El Ronda are on that tape, along with Rocky Top and Sunny Side of the Mountain, and the full Osborne Brothers band is on that project too.
Yeah, you are too.
I am too. I'm wearing a funny looking shirt.
That was the days of funny. I own it. I'm not on it, but I own it.
You had a banjo in your hand too, didn't you?
I did. I didn't play a note.
I never played a note.
What I remember about shooting that day, and you know, the level of professionalism that you bring to stuff really was amazing. It's always been amazing to me. But do you remember it just got hotter and hotter and hotter in that studio?
It sure did.
We started in the morning, and it was air conditioned, and they were just blasting it because they were saying, well, these lights, it's going to turn and it's going to get hot. And by the time you guys were recording Rocky Top to end that thing, it must have been 110 degrees in that studio. And nobody complained. Nobody, you know, but we were wiping sweat from our foreheads. It was so hot. And, you know, guys just hung in there to the end, you know, and of course, Happy Traum of Homespun is a total class act. I mean, he's great, and we got a good project out of that. Tom Adler is on there, too, and I just saw Tom about a month ago. I played in Lexington, Kentucky, and he and his wife came down, and he looks great, and he's playing more music now and doing well, so working for Kentucky Sports Medicine. So
he has chief banjo number 17, I think.
Okay.
First started, he's got one of those.
He's still got it.
Yeah, he does. Tom Adler's a good guy. He's one of the really, really good guys. If you ever met him, you'll never forget him because he's a really wonderful human being.
I want to switch the topic back to music, but you know, from the very start, you guys recorded with two banjos, and where did the idea, you know, with Ruby, of course. And where did that idea come from? Do you remember?
No, not really. Bobby could play lead, and I just thought it'd be nice to sound a little different, so we put a harmony to it. It seems like that he played... I had an RB3 raised head banjo that he played lead on, and then I played the harmony on the RB3 that Aaron McDerris has now. I don't know where the idea came from. We just thought it'd be nice to do that, you know. Most of the stuff that we did that was, I guess you would say different, original, different, whatever you want to call it, was just not planned out, just spur-of-the-moment stuff that we thought would be nice to do, you know. And the harmony all came together that same way. Just said, hey, can you do this? Yeah, if you'll do that, I'll do this. And we just did that, and it all kind of worked out pretty good. I think we did Ruby and Della May and Ho Honey Ho and Down in the Willow Garden with Bobby playing on it. And we did Harmony Banjos on that. And then Benny Birchfield and I did an instrumental album on MGM in about 1959 or 60, I think it was. We played harmony on that. And then Dale Sled and I did some things in about 1965 or 66 where we played harmony together. Dale was a good banjo player.
Yeah.
Most of the lead singers that we had in the early days were banjo players, with the exception of Red Allen and Jimmy Martin.
Hey, guys, I got Ho Honey Ho if you want to hear it, just for fun, since we're talking about twin banjos.
Well, yeah.
You want to give it a shot?
Cool.
All sure. Right, hold on. We'll get back to the regular program shortly. There you go. As we were talking about Ho Honey Ho through the miracle of modern technology, I pulled it up and we snuck it out to you.
Can you imagine? What year was that, Chief? That's like 1952?
No. 50, Ruby was in 56.
Oh, okay.
Ho Honey Ho, I think, was next. That would be 50 later in 56. Ruby came out, I think it was April of 56, and then Ho Honey Ho came out about 3 months later. You used to put out singles every 3 months. And then if you were lucky, once a year, they would put an album out with a lot of the singles on it. And they would group them together and have a called them an LP, you know, at that time. It's not like that now. But,
and Ruby was a hit, right?
Yeah, it was. Sure was. I think Bobby's voice was so unique, and the sound of those banjos was so unique that people didn't know what to think. You know, they didn't know they had no idea what was going on. And we had success with Ruby and Ho Honey Ho, and we were successful on MGM, as successful as you can be on that label at that time. And we made some mistakes though in our thinking, because when we did that instrumental album, we shouldn't have done that. That was just something we shouldn't have done, because at that time they hadn't perfected the stereo sound just yet, and whoever mixed and remixed and mastered the instrumental album completely destroyed it. It's just really bad. And they tried to do stereo on it, and it did not work at all. And I think that hurt us in our progress. But we had, in 1957, we had a number 13 song with Once More.
Sure.
It was a good song. Written by Dusty Owens out of Wheeling, West Virginia. It's a really good song, and our harmony, that was the first thing that we really featured that harmony on all the way through it, and it really worked. It worked really, really well. Shot Jackson played dobro on it, and it was a hit. That was a hit song. And we did okay with MGM. I was glad to get away from them, but I'm not saying anything bad about them, but we went as far as we could go with MGM, and we got with Decca, and Decca, we really took off with Decca then. I mean, the whole career and everything took off.
Now, in those years, I don't think I've asked you this question in exactly the way I'm going to ask it, and I might not even be phrasing it the same way, but did these record companies view what you were doing as bluegrass music or as country music?
Oh, good.
Well, bluegrass, the word bluegrass hadn't really taken effect just yet. It was still a new thing, and we were just like hillbilly music at that time. It was country, and it wasn't anything else. This is like hillbilly music. That's what we, it was music that people played that was really hard up on their luck and down and out and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Not very well off.
Hey, Sonny, when Bill asked you a question, you have to give me time to object. That time I would not have, but just pause a second, would you please?
What now?
When Bill asks you a question, you need to pause in case I need to object.
Oh, I see.
I wouldn't have objected to that one, but let's just think about it.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
All right, well, I'll tell you what, he asked me anything from now, and you just tell me what to talk.
I'll just say you may answer.
Well, I'll do that.
Okay, go ahead.
Anyway, we did okay with MGM, but we just, like I said, we made some mistakes.
Yeah. Well, I asked that question because, you know, when you read interviews with folks like Jimmy Martin and Earl Scruggs, and, you know, they talk about the fact that, that bluegrass music did not have that different identity, and that, and, you know, of course, Jimmy Martin called his own music good and country. He didn't call it bluegrass, and the Stanley Brothers didn't use the word bluegrass for a long time either. Flatt and Scruggs didn't like the word bluegrass because they associated that with Bill Monroe, right?
Well, that's the reason all of them did that. They didn't respect Bill, and every one of them got their start from Bill. It had not been for Bill. Oh, wait a minute. Steve, you didn't say you'd talk now.
Well, see, you're not giving me a say. You may answer.
Okay. All right. How come you don't have to do that with Bill?
He's not, you're not asking him questions yet.
Oh. You want to do it anyway, though.
I might.
That's just, no, you just take it out on me, that's all. Anyway, Earl and Louise would not even think about the word bluegrass. I mean, wouldn't consider it. Every time the word bluegrass came up, she would get a really weird look on her face. And the Stanley Brothers wouldn't use the word because they resented the fact that Bill Monroe made it and they didn't. And, well, that's fact. I'm telling you the truth. And, Jimmy Martin wouldn't use it because, he wouldn't get credit for anything connected with bluegrass music. And so he didn't want to use it. And let's face, good and country is about as what is the word, inane? that's a good description of nothing. Phil Monroe would say, that ain't no point of nothing right there. But that's about the truth. I think Jimmy had an album called Good and Country, and he just said that would be good for him to be good and country. Jimmy had some wild thoughts. He told me one time that the guitar run in Uncle Penn was the first time that lick had been used, and he also told me that he helped to write the second verse of Uncle Penn, and that if it had not been for his guitar playing, they wouldn't have done Rawhide. And I find that very hard to believe because I worked with Bill Monroe and I know what kind of man he was. And he wouldn't have done that at all. And Jimmy had no part of writing anything, as a matter of fact. And sounds like I'm negative on Jimmy, doesn't it? But I'm not really.
Yeah.
I'm not really. I just know him, that's all. And the guitar thing, Lester Flatt had done that Lester Flatt got it from Charlie Monroe, and Lester Flatt perfected that guitar G1 on the guitar, and Jimmy won't get credit for it, but so goes it, you know. But we never had a problem using the word bluegrass because that's what it was. It was considered bluegrass music because of Bill and because of the Bluegrass Boys. And Bill's from Kentucky, and we were from Kentucky, and I had no problem at all using bluegrass music or giving Bill Monroe credit that he deserved. I liked Bill, and there were times that I didn't like Bill. He was a very different personality, Bill was. Rough, around the edges quite a bit. And, you had to just take him for what he was worth, you know. But he, you know, as far as saying, well, Bill created this music, I'm not sure about that. And none of us planned it. And it almost, people make it out like Bill planned this in advance, you know, that he was going to do this and create this music. Well, that's just not true. None of us did that in the early days. You just played what you played and stuff that you sat on the back porch and learned. And Lester and Earl just so happened to work with Bill, and that's where the sound came from. Earl is where the sound came from. And he's actually, if you want to say who created it, he actually did. But he worked with Bill Monroe. Bill Monroe had the vehicle for him to ride on Columbia Records. And it all worked that way. And nobody should say, well, he did this and he did that. Well, everybody together did this, you know. Nobody, no certain person. Earl created the sound, but then a lot of other people could do it as well, you know, in some cases, better, I think. I prefer to listen to Lester and Earl in the early 50s. That's sort of my favorite music, but I also like a lot of things that we did, a lot of things that a lot of people did, so.
Yeah. Now, you and I both share a love for the music of the Beatles, but you discovered it late in life, and it's a funny story about how that happened. Can you relate that?
You mean about Jimmy Brock?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I stood up there driving the bus, and we had this bass player who was, if he would have had, this will sound bad, but I don't mean it to sound that bad. If he'd had a little better attitude about himself and a little more confidence, Jimmy Brock could have been one absolutely great, marvelous rock and roll bass player, but he lacked confidence. But we had him, he worked for us, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I guess, something like that. Well, I'm up there sitting one night driving the bus, and he came walking up through there. And when I would drive, I had all of them go to the back. I didn't want anybody up there riding shotgun and all that stuff. I wanted to take the time to think. And to concentrate on what I was doing. Well, Jimmy came up there one night and he said, play this. And, I looked at it and I knew who the Beatles were, but I never had really listened or paid attention to them. And, I think it was it Abbey Road? Is that what we decided was the piece that he could be built? Yeah. He gave me Abbey Road and I listened to it and I really liked a lot of the things, and he told me, he said, if you don't like this, just give it back to me. I'll go on back there in the back. And, I listened to it, and I really liked it. And I said, who are these guys? And I said, is it really them playing this music? And, well, yes, it is. And, I really liked it. And I got introduced to the Beatles like that. And when I got home, I went and bought everything that I could get. I must have spent $300 on the Beatles records and stuff like that. But that must have been 1980, I don't know, 3 or 4, about 84, I guess it was, something like that.
Wow.
And yeah, I really liked the Beatles. I really enjoyed that Abbey Road album a great deal. There were some really nice, thoughtful things on there.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff I used later on producing.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit, you know, here and there. Ideas, I'll tell you this, ideas that I got from some of the things they did.
Hmm.
You really hit upon something. I mean, I've never heard you say that before, and you just hit upon something that is kind of the source of creativity. You know, this is one reason why I think musicians like to listen to music that's not necessarily exactly the kind of music they make, because you get inspiration, and you don't never really know how you're going to use it, you know. But the fact that you actually use some production tips that you heard from Abbey Road, I find that's mind-blowing. That's incredible. I never knew that.
Eric Clapton's another guy that I listen to a lot of his stuff. I love his guitar playing. I love to watch him play the guitar.
Yeah.
That's just an absolute amazing thing to watch him play the guitar. But I learned a lot of things from him. I learned a lot of things from a lot of people. Grady Martin, a lot of things Benny Martin did, and of course Earl. But you know, I learned how to play by listening to Earl, but I learned more from studio musicians who really knew how to play background. I learned how to play background by watching these guys. Ray Eddington, Buddy Spiker's one, Benny Martin, Grady Martin, and Hal Rugg, steel players. I really learned to like that and a lot. And I learned a lot from it, and I was given the gift of being able to hear something one time, and it would stay with me forever. I could hear a lick on a piano, say. Oh, I listened to Fats Domino, too, and Pig Robbins on the piano, Roger Williams. I listened to a lot of that stuff, and I would pick up a note here and a phrase here and there, and maybe 2 years later, I'd be playing something that I would think that would go there, and I'd do it there. And sometimes it would work, sometimes it didn't. I learned a lot of things from a lot of places. The Jell-O, the commercial, J-E-L-L-O. Well,
yeah.
We had a song called Memories. I don't know if that was MGM or Decca. And I started off by using J-E-N, and, you know, it worked pretty good. And I've had 150 people say, where did you get that idea of doing that? And I'm thinking, from Jell-O, man, don't you listen to commercials? And, you know, you get ideas from every source in the world. Every source in the world. And if you just pay attention, you can really learn a whole lot, learn a bunch. I really wish that I had been as gifted a musician as Jens Kruger, because he is such a gifted man, really is. If I'd been able to execute like he can, I would have learned a whole lot more. I would have been able to do a whole lot more, but I was never I was never a great executioner, I'll put it that way.
Hey, how about Sonny and Bill? I don't want to cut off because I'm enjoying this, but the Jell-O thing is very intriguing. I don't know if a lot of people have really heard it in connection to that explanation. I can play Memories right now if you want to hear it.
Oh, okay.
I pulled it up. Let's do that, okay, Bill? Hold on a second.
Yeah, and as you're listening, you know, I invite the listeners, as they're listening to Sonny's banter part, just sing J-E-L-L-O, and it'll change your understanding of this beautiful song forever. It'll just ruin it.
it's a commercial.
All right, that took me a couple tries to get the Memories I was looking for, but that was the Jell-O theme. We just played it, and now we're back. So now the whole world is now going to sing Jell-O theme every time they hear that beautiful song by the Osmond Brothers.
Well, it worked, didn't it?
It worked great.
work, and then later on I heard, the Seldom Seen guy that plays with him, I heard him use it. I heard Bill Emerson use it on one of the Country Gentleman records.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, it worked. And what is amazing about the whole thing is that they do these things and they never know where they came from. And I'm sure Bill Emerson, he's a smart guy too. I'm sure Emerson has no idea where that came from about the Jell-O thing. I bet you.
Yeah. Well, because the way you're using it, it changes it a little bit, and you're not hearing it in the background of a commercial, you know. So it's just a great way to go from a one chord to a four chord, you know.
So they're just doing one note, da 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 da, like that.
Yeah.
I run that note up and bring the other one down at the same time.
Yeah.
Da 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 da, like that. Anyway. Well, I've had an instrumental in my mind for the last 10 years, probably, where you do nothing but play and go to a four chord, which is like G, C, and then, you know, I think I've talked to you about this, Bill, before.
Yeah.
Circle in the Drain.
Yeah, and call it Circling the Drain. Yeah. Well, I just noticed in Bluegrass Unlimited, I think it was last week or somebody, had mentioned, well, this would be a good practice thing, and they've had it did that exactly. Just go from one chord to another.
Yeah, lots of jazz books also too. When they present exercises, will go around the circle, either going in fourths or fifths, and you play one riff in one key, and then you transpose it up a fourth and do it again, and then another fourth, and suddenly you're in keys that are pretty far away from where you started. Pretty quick.
Yeah.
pretty quickly. Well, you got me thinking that it would be fun to write an instrumental that just, like, strung a lot of 1960s commercial themes all in one thing, so you could have, you know, plop, plop, fizz, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. And then, and then, you can trust your car to the man who wears the star.
Oh, yeah, you know who that, was Testico. I was just talking about this today. See the USA in your Chevrolet, remember that?
Yeah. Sure, Dinosaur.
Yeah, Dinosaur did that. She's from here, by the way. You could do a million of those things.
And the great thing about them now, the great thing about them now is nobody remembers them, so they'll think you wrote them all.
No, of course not. And I mentioned one today about Quiz, the best nickel candy there is. Do any one of you know what that is?
I do not.
No, I do not.
WHIZ, it was a candy bar. And back in the 40s, there was a guy named Gabriel Heater. And he was a newscaster, and that was his sponsor. It is the best nickel candy there is. Now, there's Gabriel Heater in the news. Gabriel Heater, and was sponsored by Whiz Candy Bar.
There's a song.
My gosh.
Oh, man.
Wow.
This has been a blast for me. I hope you guys have enjoyed doing this, but
anytime. I enjoy Bill and so much. I appreciate him so much, and it's such a pleasure to get to talk to him. Bill is a business partner for one thing, but he's one of the best friends I have for another thing, and one of my favorite people on this earth, anyway.
Wow. Well,
that may change later.
I feel the same way, and I'm honored to get to know you. And, you know, the first time I ever met you, and I've reminded you of this, but I'm not sure you really remember it, was at Jim Orange's Orange Blossom Park in Waynesboro, Virginia, in 1978, and I guess you had not had the Granada that long at that point then, right?
I got it New Year's Day of 1978.
Yeah, so this would have been that following summer, and I was just shaking in my boots and walked up to you and introduced myself, and I just said I was a banjo player, and you handed the Granada across the record table to me and said, play something. And I have no idea what I played, but that was the first time I met you. And then we had a conversation about how much you loved that banjo. And then we didn't really get to know one another until we worked together with the International Bluegrass Music Museum the year that, you and Bobby were inducted to the Hall of Fame.
That's right. You know, that was at Jim Orange's place up there, there was a guy came up to me that afternoon, just as I got off stage. He said, "Why don't you play some clawhammer?" And I said, "I don't play clawhammer." He said, "Well, Ralph Family did." And I said, "What's going on with Ralph Family then?"
Oh, man.
He got mad. Oh, boy.
Hey guys, this let me just tell you this. This was Bill's idea. For Bill, I appreciate it so much that you say let's hook Sonny in. This was great. I consider this my birthday present. My birthday's tomorrow. I've enjoyed listening to you guys talk and discuss and Bill, everybody call. And this has just been a joy. I've thoroughly enjoyed every second of it.
Well, happy birthday, Steve.
Yeah, happy birthday. We ought to do it again.
We should. Yeah, we can do it anytime. Bill, I'm gonna get a mixer board so I can make this work a little better, I promise.
That would be less stress for you, for sure.
Yes, it would. And if you see what I'm doing, it's almost a yoga-like thing that I have to do to hold the phone and the speaker and the microphone. But it works. And I think there's not a lot of structure to what I do, but I think we made our point. And gosh, I've enjoyed it thoroughly. And I'm going to suggest that we get out of here. Normally I get out with a banjo tune and I had, Bill Evans, I had your clarinet polka set up to be the end, but I want to get out of here with, Up This Hill and Down by the Osborne Brothers. Yes. It's just one of my favorite tunes.
Yes, my favorite too.
Yeah, all right, let's do that. Hey, thanks a lot for calling in and making this work for me. I've had a blast.
Thank you, Steve.
See you, Bill.
Take care, Chief. I'll see you in a couple weeks here, man.
Oh, all right, great.
All right.